Welcome to Grindstone, Abattoir Magazine's podcast and the home of cutting-edge psychological horror news, reviews, and interviews. If you enjoy our podcast, make sure to subscribe to our feed, read our blog, and keep your eye out for the e-zine.
Yo.
Howdy.
Yo, yo.
What's up?
And just so you know, the big red button has been pushed, so anything you say is now on the record.
Okay, that's good to know.
Oh, man, that's bad. Bad.
I tell you. I start the recording before I start Skype. That's how I roll.
Okay.
Well, this evening I am raising a scotch in memoriam of Steve Jobs.
I know, right? That is so weird.
Oh, shit, man. That's crazy.
I mean, yeah. And so soon after he stepped down. When did he step down? I mean, it's only been
6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Whew. Dang. It's going to be interesting to see who fills those shoes. I mean, not at Apple per se, but in the world of technology, because holy crap.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to say something about this coming so soon after the non-event, but I didn't know how to do it without looking like a complete ass.
Yeah.
Something about...
What are you trying to say? He gave up an embarrassment? What are you trying to say exactly?
Or he wanted to one-up, you know, the guy that replaced him or something. I don't know.
Now I want to make it clear. This is supposed to be a conversation about horror, not bad taste.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Although these days, with the horror market being what it is, you know.
Do not get me started. What the hell are we talking about this evening anyway?
Either
of y'all read Horns?
No.
I haven't yet, no. It's taken me like 3 months to get through one book, so...
You obviously aren't using a Kindle.
No, I haven't gotten a Kindle yet. But now that they're going to be dirt-ass cheap, I'll probably be getting one later this year.
Seriously, I mean, that is amazing how inexpensive they're getting.
Oh, it's $79, I mean, for the base model. They're going to sell millions upon millions come Christmas time, and I can't wait to see what January brings sales-wise. So.
Yeah. That's going to be exciting.
Yes, it is.
Well, I bring that up because there's some elements in it that are drawing that line again between, you know, what is horror and what is magical realism. And that also kind of goes back to some of the stuff from Stephen King's The Body, Shawshank Redemption, and what's the other one? Well, God, even stuff like Needful Things, it's very interesting how, I mean, you know Joe Hill is Stephen King's son, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Wait,
okay,
what?
So Joe Hill is Stephen King's son.
Joe Hill.
That's who wrote Horns.
Oh, okay. All right.
And Heart-Shaped Box.
Okay.
Yeah, which I'm reading right now.
Yeah, I haven't. I just haven't read it yet. Actually, it's in paperback form, and it's got that nasty paperback smell.
Is it
musty? Is it not? What the hell is that stink?
Here's something.
January brings sales wise. So.
Yeah. That's going to be exciting.
Books don't go
yes,
bad.
It is.
Only writers do.
There you go.
And usually after lots of scotch.
Yes, I'm well on my way. So the one terrible thing about the two books I bought from Joe Hill is the fact that I got them at Borders as they were doing their. We're dying. Please buy something,
right?
You know, to feed the vultures or desiccated corpses. And so
later this year,
Joe Hill.
Seriously, I mean,
well, he got
that
money.
Is amazing how
you know.
So that came off
see,
the borders.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. Because in the publishing world, those aren't returns. So that's a plus on the author side.
Yeah,
that's true. And it fucked the publisher, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah,
exactly.
All right, so here's what I want to talk about, because you guys are talking about these books, and I haven't even heard of them, actually.
Oh, my God. That's terrible.
So I guess my question is, other than the classics and sort of the indie guys that I know, who should we be reading that's new, that's good horror? I don't know how new Joe Hill is, but...
I mean, he's been around just a couple of years... really, you know, it's so weird because I've been out of books, you know, just buying books spontaneously for a very long time. And now that I'm really broke, it's going to get even more difficult to do that. So, you know, I've mostly been sticking with a lot of the, you know, the indie folk. I think Jeremy Shipp is putting on some pretty decent stuff now and again, but he's just so weird.
Yeah.
He transcends genres. I mean,
it's horror mixed with Zorro mixed with, I mean.
Yeah, just absurdist crazy. Yeah. And then he's just got that black humor that's in there also that you're just like, should I be laughing? Should I be cringing? Should I, what should I be doing right now? I'm not quite sure. I like it, but I don't know.
I don't understand how I'm supposed to react to this.
Well, it's like, you know, okay, I downloaded a sample of Please Tip Your Ninjas or whatever it was.
Right.
And I was like, really? I'm paying, you know, if I had bought this, I would have paid 99 cents for this, but yeah, he is.
At the same time, he puts out something like Camp, which
I love Camp.
Camp is just an awesome, awesome effing story, and so is Wolves and Sheep. He's got some short stories out there that are just killer, and they did them on what's the horror podcast? God, I suck.
Grindstone.
Yeah, besides Grindstone.
We have all of three episodes over 6 months.
The one that's the Escape Pods.
Pseudopod?
Pseudopod, yeah. There we go. I heard those on Pseudopod, and they just were just killer. Absolute killer.
Well, he was tweeting today about a free anthology that he's in, so I've got a copy of that I'm going to peruse.
The Monsters one.
Yeah, because I haven't read much. I don't think I've ever actually read any of his stuff other than that sample of Please Tip Your Ninjas.
You should definitely give some of his stuff a shot. I'm really interested in reading Vacation. I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
Yeah.
Well, even who are some indies that we should be checking out?
Paul Eller Cooley, Scott Roche, and Jake Bible.
Exactly.
Buy my shit. I have medical bills to pay, you bitches.
Once they get their Kindles come Christmas, just go wild, people.
That's
wild.
Right, man. Go buy like Fiendlets and Closet Treats and Tattoo and any other damn thing I feel like. If I wipe my ass, put it on paper, scan it in, make it into an ebook, buy it.
There we go.
Okay,
so you're at it, bug your favorite authors to get on my right. There we go.
Present company excluded.
Are you talking about yourself in the third person again?
Yes, I am. But I haven't started giggling yet, so it's okay.
Okay.
So who should we be reading besides us?
God, I feel so terrible saying this, but I really just have not been reading at all this year.
I'm in that same boat, and I haven't really read anybody new, discovered anyone new in a long time, so I don't know.
But I mean, you can still push folks like Joe R. Lansdale, who aren't very well known, but write really good stuff.
Oh, well, yeah.
And he's like Texas's best little kept secret.
No, definitely.
And, you know, I actually took a writing course with a guy at a con in 1988. So I got to talk a lot with him, and he actually remembers me. I've been to like four or five of his signings, and he remembers me.
You're old, dude.
Yeah, exactly. And so is he. And he's actually gone indie.
Yeah.
Okay.
He had fat contracts, and he dumped them, and he's gone independent.
Oh, yeah.
So he's one of those guys who literally used to write a short story to – pay for the washer guy to fix the washing machine.
Oh, exactly.
I mean, that's how small town Texas he is, and where he grew up was his wife would mix up this badass popcorn when they needed money. And this popcorn that she found was this recipe of it's like Chipotle habanero stuff. And this is back in the 70s, I guess. And she'd make this popcorn and make him eat it. Because one night he ate it and had the weirdest ass dreams and woke up next morning and wrote like a 15-pager that ended up netting them a couple hundred dollars.
Nice.
So whenever something,
so she made food to give him nightmares so he can write them down.
Absolutely. That's so basically fantastic. Whenever, you know, it was like school tuition's due or anything else, he'd be like groaning because he could hear the popcorn maker going. He'd be like, oh God, not again. So she'd bring him a huge bowl, make him eat the whole thing.
Nice.
He'd put him to bed. He'd wake up at like 4 a.m. with his brain just going insane and, you know, bang out 2 or 3 short stories, all that which would sell and bring in cash.
Nice.
So, I mean, you talk about horror. Yeah, I'm talking about food and horror. Yeah. I need that kind of experience. Somebody hand me that stuff.
Yeah.
I know.
So, one of the things I'm going to start playing around. And I wrote the young adult novel. Now I'm going to start playing around in even younger kids' books.
Yeah, I saw that. That'll be cool.
And I'm going to bring some horror elements to that. Mm. And so, you know, I'm curious to know what you guys think about horror in young adult or even kids books.
Yeah. And 100%.
And what the,
that's when I got hooked on horror, was elementary school.
And, you know, what kind of stuff is you know, because you're one of the things that I'm going to have to keep a close eye on is not to get too cartoony.
Right.
But at the same time, not to scare the parents.
I think what you have to do, though, at that point, and this is actually a really good topic of discussion, and I'll jump to something in a moment, but let me just have my say here. I think I think children's books. You know, Stephen King had this whole diatribe, and I can't remember which book it was, about how easy it was to scare kids and, you know, do terrible things to them in books. But, I mean, all you got to do is look at how at the fables and legends and everything else we teach them, the storybooks, how easy it is to turn one of those things into a horror story.
Right.
You know, the Big Bad Wolf or, you know, Little Red Riding Hood, whatever else, it's so easy to just make it just something just nasty and horrible.
Well, they were already pretty nasty and horrible.
Exactly, but the way our generation was told those stories was not that way, and right. The generation behind us is even further removed from that. They've been pussified. So I think the main thing, and of course I haven't been studying the children's literature stuff because I have no idea what's going on. I just really dug the Harry Potter books. But I can say this: if I try and put myself back when I was 10 or 12, you know, my parents were pretty liberal with what I was. I could read anything I wanted as long as they knew what it was, and that was kind of the agreement that was there. They wouldn't shelter me from anything that was written. It was just a matter of they wanted to know what it was. My dad would usually read it before I read it,
right?
So that he can answer questions or ask questions,
right,
about what I thought about what I was reading. And that was like the best way to do something because it gave us a topic of discussion where I could get a grown-up's view of what it was I had seen and vice versa. So it worked really well from that standpoint. But I think in children's literature, if you're going to try and go on the dark side, I think suspense is more where you want to go. I think it's
exactly.
It's much easier to do that kind of thing. I mean, my favorite scene in Closet Treats, that entire book – has no gore, has nothing more than a foot coming through a glass, you know, a sliding glass door.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's the ice cream man's leg. Mm-hmm. And it's enough to scare the ever-loving crap out of the protagonist, you know, Alan at that point, because of all the other tension that's built up. At least that's how it worked when I wrote it. How it works when you read it, I don't know. That's up to you. But that is my favorite scene from that entire freaking book. It's just that one where he just hears the clicks and scratches at the door, and the next thing you know, he hears it slide, and then through the vertical blinds comes this foot. That's, I mean, just something as simple as that is enough to trigger a response. And I think the R.L. Stine stuff, I don't know anything about the Goosebumps stuff, but I think that's probably more where it lies too, from what I know of it, which is very little. I think that you have to go after the monster in the closet stuff, but you can be a lot more imaginative in that arena by looking at the everyday stuff that, you know, scares the hell out of little kids. I mean, how many of us have woken up in the middle of the night, looked at some pile of clothes on the floor or a jacket laying on a chair or a cat on the floor or something like that, and your mind immediately twisted into something that it's not?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, that will give you goosebumps. It will give the adrenaline surge. It gets you going. There's no reason you can't do the same thing in literature. There's absolutely no reason why you can't. In fact, I think it works best when you do that. Stephen King is famous for showing everybody else our dirty little secrets, because he'll talk about these kinds of things all the time. It's like he's the bastard giving away our magic tricks. I hate him. but the bottom line is, as a writer, it's really interesting to see what he has to say on these things, because it really does highlight what we actually do. And I think that if you're going to write dark fiction, it's not about the tropes. It's not about all that other stuff. It's what you do with it. And I think the focusing on the suspense and the thriller elements to it is absolutely integral to making it work for any genre. But if you're going to go after kids, gore is out the window.
Right.
Sex is out the window.
Right.
Unless you're talking about dogs screwing on the sidewalk, that might be okay. Who knows?
probably not.
You really have to look at it like a PG-13 movie. That's what you got to go look at. And speaking of PG-13 movies, have either of you seen Insidious?
No.
No.
Not yet. It's in my queue, but I haven't seen it.
Both suck.
I haven't had time to read books, let alone watch movies.
Well, I had to go see this because I heard about it on Bloody Good Horror, and then I had to go see it, and then I had to go buy the Blu-ray, and then I had to dissect the hell out of it. It is the best horror movie, quote-unquote horror movie, made since Poltergeist.
Wow.
Nice.
I think. It's only got a PG-13 rating. There's almost no gore in this flick at all.
Good None. So far.
It's all back to basics.
Good.
It's all back to basics and being creepy as hell. And I think that's what makes it so good. It kind of lost something on being on the Blu-ray, but I think that's because after you've seen it in theater, watching it on your TV is kind of – it loses something. Plus, it was a second viewing, so I knew it was going to happen anyway. But the first shot out of the box, it was just such a fantastically bizarre way to do stuff, and they did it so well, and they did it on a budget of $750,000.
Nice.
Well, and see, you know, that's the thing about horror. It doesn't have to have a huge budget, and it doesn't have to be – explicit. I mean, you know, PG-13 is enough to scare the crap out of somebody. I mean, yeah, crap. I mean, you know, PG is enough to scare the crap out of somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, I mean, going back to the horror that I enjoyed growing up, I really liked the old classic black and white movies, you know, the original Wolfman, the original Dracula, the original Mummy. Yeah. And, you know, that wasn't, you know, I wasn't a contemporary with those. I'm not as old as Cooley. but I mean, you know, my brother, who's older than I, had it, my stepbrother had a 8mm film projector, and he had a lot of those movies on film. And when he would come down for the summer, he'd bring his projector and we'd watch these movies on the wall of my bedroom, and it was amazing, you know, to scare myself silly off of stuff that by today's standards is probably G-rated. I mean,
oh yeah, yeah.
It is,
yeah,
definitely. Absolutely.
I think if you want to talk like, you know, children's horror, you need to get back to the feeling of around the campfire.
Yes, and absolutely.
That rhythm and cadence and that building of the tension and the simplicity of it. There's a great, you know, every Halloween, my kids are getting too old now, but every Halloween we'd pull out all the you know, picture books, the children's, you know, Halloween books and stuff, and there's one called, you know, Little Old Lady who's not Afraid of Anything or something like that. And it's a really simple story that she's on her way home, you know, on a cold, you know, autumn night, you know, it's dark out, there's a big moon, and comes down the path and hears, you know, comes across two boots going clomp, clomp, and they're just there,
just two boots moving along. And she's like, I'm not afraid of you, and moves past and comes to a pair of pants going swish, swish. And stuff like that, you know. I mean, it just builds as all of a sudden this kind of scarecrow ghost builds itself on the path and chases her home. And it's those kind of things. Very simple, but add the sounds, add the feeling and the emotion and build that tension. And you don't have to have any gore. You don't have to have any real monsters or anything in there. You know, you're just telling that story and building it. And that's what kids latch onto. You know, I mean, with kids, it's that same feeling of throw them up in the air and catch them, you know, again, yeah. Again.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, yeah.
That's what they want. They want that base, very just gut-wrenching, primal feeling. They want to feel that. And that's what you got to go for. You know, think of it, you know, when writing it or, you know, reading it of, you know, how, I mean, definitely reading it aloud is the great thing. That's the one wonderful thing about children's books is they really should be read aloud.
I agree.
Because
I agree
you're usually reading them to kids, not kids reading them to themselves.
Right.
So play with it that way so that, you know, you've got this great, you know, verbal story. This, you know, this great story that's you know, you're being able to tell with your voice. And if it, you know, if you've got the right feel when you're reading it aloud, then it's going to come across on the page, and that's going to make all the difference there.
Do either of you remember Bunnicula?
Oh yeah,
yeah, I love Bunnicula.
Oh, yeah.
For those of you in the audience who have no freaking clue what we're talking about, it was a vegetarian bunny rabbit or vampire.
Yeah, yeah.
A little bunny rabbit that happened to be a vampire that only sucked the death out of vegetables.
Right.
It was kind of a cool story, but I remember being read that aloud in, like, you know, fourth grade or whatever. It was earlier than that. I can't remember. It was a long time ago. Anyway, yeah, I mean, it's just stuff like that. Has the potential. It has kind of a dark side, but at the same time, it was fun. It was just fun. And when you said something about talking about the campfire, how many freaking horror movies have a starting scene where somebody's talking about, they're setting it up with a story around the campfire? One of the most famous is John Houseman at the beginning of Carpenter's 1982 The Fog, where he's telling a story at the campfire. Now, granted, he's leaving out some details, but he's basically setting everything up right there in the first 5 minutes of the film and scaring the hell out of these little kids. It's all about narrative. It's all about passing it down. I bitched recently in one of my many rants about, you know, vampires. Basically, the idea of them is of a cautionary tale for women. And, you know, a lot of the campfire stories that you know, the ones that don't border on the absolute absurd, you know, are basically parables.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so I think that's why they stick with us so long after we grow into adults, is because they are parables. And I think that writing children's literature is very – I would never try it myself because I just – it would be awful. Just trying to keep from slipping an F-bomb in there would be impossible for me.
Yeah, we've seen what you've done to the puppets, Cooley. So.
Yeah, it's bad enough. I've abused and I've perverted the Muppets.
Yeah.
Goes my podcast. Go to my site and see stuffing. You'll
no,
love it.
No, don't.
There's the biggest endorsement right there. Scott Burr saying, "Don't do it.
Don't do it. Don't throw me in that bar patch."
Oh, well, there's another one, Uncle Remus, right? Okay, remember the scene where Brer Rabbit's going to get thrown in the briar patch?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's all built up with this, all this suspense, don't do this, don't do this, and all that kind of stuff, and tricking the villain into it. Well, when you're a little kid, you don't want Brer Rabbit to get hurt.
Right.
I mean, there's all these different things you just don't want to have happen, and yet you're tantalized with it. For those few moments, you have an area of conflict that the reader doesn't necessarily know how it's going to turn out. And children mean children, depending on their age anyway. You might be able to get away with snookering them into something like that and then flipping the tables on them. And, of course, they're going to want a happy ending. I don't do happy endings. But
yes, that is one thing with this project that I'm working on with Ed Delaney. It's going to be happy endings because this is going to be a series, hopefully, if it's well received. Right. But I want it to be in that sort of the Lemony Snicket books and some of the other dark kids lit that's out there, where there is a dark element to it. Maybe not quite that dark, but.
Well, I mean, with that, you can always have, you know, the protagonists escape, and that's the happy ending.
Right. Yeah, they live.
not that everyone's hugging and having hot cocoa at the end, but they're like, all right, all fingers, all toes, we're good, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
Minor abrasions and a couple of bruises to yeah. Maybe a scar to tell the story, but that's about it.
And one of them may wet themselves. That's perfectly acceptable.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, that's the gore in children's.
Yeah,
fluid of baby Ruth. You know, I'm scared. That may cover it.
A different bodily fluid. yeah, I think. But yeah, I think that with kids lit, it's you have to be a little more subtle.
Sure, absolutely, absolutely.
But there's a lot of interesting. You know, leaving all of the stupid paranormal romance stuff out of it. There's a lot of interesting, really dark kids fiction that's come up over the last few years, and I go into the bookstores with my kids. My kids are 6, 9, and 11, and I've got a great little test bed right here, and seeing what kind of books they pick up and reading through them and looking at them, and my oldest reads faster than I do, and she just tears through books, but you know, seeing some of the stuff that she likes, it's amazing what kind of choices the kids have today. But there is that dark edge to a lot of stuff. So,
yeah, definitely. Cool. I mean, if you're talking, you know, older kids in the middle grade stuff, there's a good series, Lockdown, Escape from Furnace, the Escape from Furnace series. I bet I have the book around here somewhere. Alexander Gordon Smith. And it's a whole crazy kids who are, you know, the bad kids, you know, who'd be going to juvie. Well, this is juvie basically in hell. That's what it is. You're locked in for life. There's no
scared
out.
Straight, it's scared dead.
Exactly. And it's freaky, and I mean, you know, it's middle grade completely, and it's a good series. You know, it's fast, it's funky, it's grotesque in parts, and you know, there's three books in the series, so the first one must have done pretty well. But you know, it's a good one. My son's read all three. I've read the first two. They're definitely, you know, they're definitely fun. I mean, there's some gore elements, but you know, not
well, with the middle grades, you can get away with a little bit of that.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, that's a good series. But there's definitely, I'd have to say you've got your paranormal romance stuff, your Twilight style, which there's every copycat under the sun out there, but you can never really put those in horror category at all.
Right.
They're just not. There's nothing scary going on in there at all.
Well, there's some scary things going on, but you know.
Well, yeah, there is.
It's a different
writing.
The irony.
The words.
You know, we all just sit here with our little piddly sails and talk about this, and there's no jealousy there at all.
No, it's more horror at the fact that shit got published. How many times can you call a character, oh, he was a sexy Adonis? She used Adonis like 17 times in the first goddamn book.
You counted?
But you know.
I read somebody who counted. I'm reading that garbage. I read like 5 pages of it. I was about ready to vomit in the toilet.
Those books have had to go through to get published, do you blame the writer? Or do you blame the frickin' editor who let 17 Adonises go through that fucking book?
I blame the genre.
Well, no. See, well, here's the thing, and this is not entirely off topic. I was on Goodreads. I'm part of a I don't know if it's the forum or whatever under Goodreads, a sub forum or whatever on Christian fiction. And one of the things that we're ranting about there is very similar to this, and that is the audience is more concerned with the message than the quality of the fiction.
Yes.
Right. And so that happens in paranormal romance. They're more concerned with, you know, it's the same thing with Harlequins or whatever. They're more concerned with, you know, the message than with the quality of the story.
Right.
So, it's not even message, it's image.
Yeah. Well, the underlying sort of the core of it, and as long as they hear that the you know, the
poor misunderstood woman gets saved by a, you know, muscle bound dark brooding guy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep.
For some reason you that just tripped right off of your tongue.
It's because I've been ranting about it for too damn long.
So yeah, I think that's well, and so about the message, getting back to that, for getting back to horror fiction, real horror fiction, you said it's a parable, and a lot of the fiction that I grew up, a lot of the horror fiction that I grew up on, and the movies especially, are all cautionary tales of one kind or another, all morality tales. And it's interesting, growing up, how I and where I grew up, and you guys probably aren't that much different. You know, horror fiction was, you know, demonized. And it's odd when, if you look at the message of most of these, most of the horror films and horror stories that we read growing up, they're preaching the same morality. You know, don't have sex before you get married. And
if you have sex, you die. You do drugs, you die. You do alcohol, you die. If you smoke, you die.
Yeah, basically, you know, the only person that lives till the end is the virginal girl.
The virgin, yes.
So.
Jamie.
That's right.
Right.
Jamie's the only one that survives ever. Although that actually brings me back to Horns. There's a couple of passages in Horns that are just amazing. I don't know if you know the story at all, but let me just say this. I mean, it's something you read on the first page anyway, so I don't think it's a spoiler. The character wakes up, and he wakes up with horns growing out of his head.
Yep.
Devil horns.
Okay.
Just growing out of his head. No idea why. He's hungover. Can't remember what he did the night before. So part of the book is him trying to figure out what the hell is up with these horns and why he's got them. And then they start doing very interesting things.
The horns do.
Yes, but there's several sections in the book, and there's one particular section, and I'm not going to really go into too much detail for fear of spoiling it, but he's giving a sermon. And it's such an interesting sermon because it is talking about God versus Satan. It is talking about the fact that they're pretty much one and the same, and the only thing that differs is what you do with the power, so to speak. And it is a very interesting conversation. Now, granted, it's given during a drunken, confused, angry, total misunderstood, you know, the guy has no idea what he's talking about half the time anyway. He's so blitzed out of his mind at this point. But he makes some rather salient points in there. And I think that is something really fun to play with. In this age of sociopaths who run billion-dollar companies people who basically say anything to get their way and make you think they're your friend and everything else, and us being, you know, adults, we can look back at our teenage years in our childhood years, and we see those people very clearly.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not they grew out of it, I don't know. One hopes either that, or one hopes they're locked up somewhere before they did any real damage. but they existed, and the stories like Horns and et cetera really highlight that facet of, you know, that part of development of our childhood, because it's not just about that story is not just about what's happening to the character now, but it's also a reflection of what happened during his childhood, his teenage years, when he was growing and he didn't see all these other things going on. Mm-hmm. But when he's telling them to you and through the narrator's voice, obviously you as a reader are starting to make those connections. Now, the pinnacle of childhood literature, I would think, is if you could somehow do that at the same time, is if you could bring that kind of realization to show those patterns that happen when somebody was growing up versus when they're adults. Granted, most childhood fiction, teenage fiction, you're going to have to deal with teens as protagonists. You're just going to have to.
Right.
Well, there may be a way to bring that in. Like, you know, oh, well, I was friends with him at 4 years old. He used to pull my diapers off when I was two, or, you know, he used to steal my Star Wars characters, or, you know, stuff like that. The little indiscretions that kind of pile up after a time.
Well, you know, and it's there's been stories and movies and shows where, you know, the teenager is, you know, thinking back on when they threw the rock through Mrs. What's-Her-Face's, you know, old lady blah blah blah's window, scared her to death, you know, and having to, you know, but never told anyone he was the one who threw the rock through the window and literally made her have a heart attack.
Yeah.
I mean, just the simple kid stuff that goes really, really wrong.
And that very thing is what drives Needful Things with Stephen King.
Right.
If you look at all the little horrible things those characters do one another, they're so petty.
Oh, yeah.
They're the most petty things in the universe. They're not worth killing somebody over. But the fact is they're just struck at the right time in the right way.
Yeah.
And I think that's completely the genius of that book. Literature people, yeah, Stephen King sucks, whatever. That is a brilliant story just from the fact that he's pulling apart the human condition in that way. And I think that's a very important thing to try and bring to your writing. And actually horror, I think, is, you know, true horror, not this garbage, you know, Jason, Freddy,
right.
crap. When you're really talking about true horror, you're talking about seriously dissecting that. It is literature that's got this other edge to it, is the way it should be. And that, I think that's what we probably ought to strive as writers to bring to it, because I think it actually opens things up quite a bit when you actually get into a character's head and you start seeing how they're seeing things. You start looking at how they look at the world, because it's so important to see things through their eyes. Otherwise, what you're trying to explain to the reader doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I just think it's something we as writers have to keep in mind. And if you go back and you look at the great horror stories that stick with you, you will probably find that kind of stuff. Edgar Allan Poe was very good at it.
Oh yeah.
Well, that's what I love. That's what I love about horror fiction in general, is it lets you examine those darker spots in the human condition and really expose them. But you can't do that in other genres.
Right. Well, I think a master of, you know, juxtaposing the horror and darkness of, you know, childhood with the brightness and innocence is Ray Bradbury. I mean, think about some of those stories. I mean, he really knows how to draw you in and paint those wonderful summers, those wonderful autumns. I mean, you feel it, you smell it, you breathe it. And then, you know, turns it. And he's not one that goes super dark. He's not one that, you know, flips it and goes, here's the shadow that's going to totally kill you now, blah, blah, blah. He never quite does that. But he goes, here's the shadow that's on the edge, that's always right there, that's right at twilight, that's looking at you. Here's this, that's right behind you, that, you know, the whisper on the wind that, you know, is not just the wind and things like that. I mean, so, you know, some of Bradbury's stories when I was a kid always just chilled me to the bone, even reading them at, you know, 90 degree weather at 10 o'clock at night in the middle of summer. You know, you're just like, oh my God, wow. It you know, really hits home. And that's, I think that's part of it, is bringing about that emotion with it, of the joy of being, and the freedom of being a kid, but the cost of that freedom.
And, Jake, what is a story, all summer in a day? Is that what it's called?
Oh, there's that one. Yeah, that's the classic.
Yeah.
You know, you know, he's got, you know, whatever, you know, his, what was it? Is it a novella or the novel, you know, Dandelion Wine?
Yeah, it's out of Dandelion Wine.
Yeah.
That's a short story collection.
Something, you know, Wicked This Way Comes.
Oh, yeah. Something Wicked This Way Comes is classic. I, you know, absolutely love that.
And they made it a really terrible movie.
I don't know. I liked the movie as a kid.
Ah!
You know, that's when I watched it. It was great as a kid. I mean, it's actually, and it, you know, my kids have seen it, and it scared the crap out of them. They're like, ah!
The best part of that movie was Jason Robards, but then again, the best part of nearly every movie Jason Robards has been in was Jason Robards. So.
That is true.
Parenthood being an anomaly.
I you know, for me, the other thing that I just consumed voraciously as a kid was, and do as an adult too, is The Twilight Zone.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I've been rewatching those on Netflix.
Yeah. Outer Limits.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Well, and, you know, and talk about examining the human condition. You know, nobody did it better than Serling and his team of writers.
Yeah.
You know, it's just. And those, you know, they weren't doing anything but retelling stories that had already been told. But, I mean, you know, there are only, you know, 8 original stories or whatever. But, you know, the one that sticks with me is the one of that's about the woman who's in the hospital and she's apparently been horribly disfigured and, you know, it turns out that she looks just like us and all the doctors and the people on this planet, you know, are these absolutely horrid looking creatures.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's, but the one that stuck with me, the most and the longest was, I think it's called Time Enough at Last, where the guy is this, he's this voracious reader.
There's a nuclear war
and he's in the bank vault and his glasses break at the end. And so now he can't read any of the books that he's, you know, I mean, that's horrible. It's terrible. Yeah.
Well, and part of, I mean, Serling's genius was he told you the moral and he told you basically what was going to happen
before the story
first
started.
Two lines. Yeah, as it happens. His introduction basically told you, this is how it's all going to go to shit. Okay, enjoy. And you're hooked because you're like, okay, how does it go to shit?
Yeah.
I want to see. It's actually going to shit.
And you could say the same thing about Tales from the Crypt. I mean, it was basically they were using the crazy trope of the Crypt Keeper, but it was more or less exactly the same damn thing.
Oh yeah.
And that was actually kind of the cool part about the Twilight Zone was the fact that you had that narration at the very beginning. That sounded like it was trying to ponder some philosophical, great philosophical truth, and asking a great, you know, question, and then suddenly, Gesundheit, it would just kind of go crazy from there. And I think that was one of the great things about it. It is the way it did that, and I think that's one of the. I mean, it's you know, pardon me for tooting my own horn, but when I was doing the Fiend short stories. My favorite part of the Fiend's short stories is when I finished the Fiend short stories and I would do my own little, you know, spiel after it to basically talk about, you know, sort of what kind of thing actually drove me to write the story or my thoughts on what the story's quote unquote moral would be.
Yeah.
It's just fun to do. And it's just something that kind of sticks with us. I mean, I know it's kind of kitschy now, you know, it's a little bit of a cliche, but I really love that about The Twilight Zone. I really love that about Outer Limits. I really love that about all those shows where, you know, you had that kind of connection with a disembodied voice or whatever else that would kind of set the stage for you. Mm-hmm. And actually, that kind of harkens back to theater. If you look at the original Greek the original Greek plays.
Right.
The chorus would come out basically more or less tell you what the hell was going to happen.
Yep.
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 And then it would go on. I mean, you go look at the beginning of Oedipus Rex, go back to the beginning of Ares, you go back to any of those, you're going to see that.
Yeah. And the chorus would hop up, you know, in between too and go, aren't these people crazy?
This is crazy.
This is nuts. It's horrible. Why are you still sitting here watching it? But let the show go on.
And you know, Shakespeare did that too. I mean, he did that all the time in his own works, and it was really funny to see it happen. It was just it's always funny to go back and I have an English degree. I studied all these different literature from all these different time periods. And you look at all the plays that were coming out 1500s, 1600s, and that's exactly what they would do. That's how yep. Whether it was Ben Jonson or, you know, Billy Boy Shakespeare or, you know, any of those folks that were running around at that time. And you even look at the Victorian period, they were basically doing the same kind of thing. It right. was no longer a quote-unquote Greek chorus, but it was damned close.
Yeah, they could accomplish the same thing with asides and monologues and breaking the fourth wall and talking to the audience directly was perfectly acceptable. And I like getting the author's point of view on the stories that they wrote. So I like stuff like what you're talking about, you know, especially in short story collections where they give the authors a few paragraphs or whatever to sort of give you their perspective, whether it's beforehand or afterwards.
And I'm actually doing that in the ebooks I'm releasing right now. I put out Fiendlets, and that's got a comment for every short story. And then the version of Tattoo I just pushed up, I did that as well, which has a little bit of an essay. And Closet Treats is actually going to have the essay in it that sparked it.
Nice.
Okay.
So, you know, The Death of Childhood, the infamous one that everybody hounded me about until I actually wrote Closet Treats.
Right.
So, you know, I think there is something to be said for that. But I think that a lot of that, you know, we put in our writing anyway. Stephen King used to joke all the time about and actually wrote in one of his books. I don't remember which one it was. I think it was Secret Window, Secret Garden. About the fact that some dumbass would always ask, "Where do you get your ideas from?" You know, and I've heard Scott Sigler's response to that, which is hilarious. And people just go, "What?" He's like, "Well, I see something. I think, well, how does somebody get eaten at the end of this?" So
I've never actually heard that one.
He's like, "I'm a simple man. That's how I do this." And you know, there's a certain amount of truth in that. I mean, we see things. Like I was talking about, you've got the chair, you've got the shirt on the back of the chair, and you get up, you're bleary-eyed, it's freaking middle of the night, you got to get ready for work, whatever, and you see that chair from a certain angle, and I'll be damned if it doesn't look like some old man staring back at you.
Yep.
You know, with his head down, and maybe the buttons are catching some moonlight or whatever and shining back at you, and for that briefest second, you are absolutely positively certain, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that there is a creature or an old man or a ghost or whatever you want to call it sitting in a chair staring at you.
Yep.
And we do that every day. We see stuff like that where our brains don't quite process what we're seeing. They can't quite make it out, so they try and fill it with something that it understands. It doesn't understand what the eyes is. What the eyes are telling it, but the brain tries and fills in the information anyway.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah.
So it gets confused, and this happens all the time, and this is what happens when people have delusions. This is what happens when people are really messed up on hallucinogenics. You know, the brain is trying to process what it sees, and because the oculars are screwed up or whatever else, it's having to process the information in a way that changes it into something that you just normally wouldn't experience. And horror is the perfect freaking vehicle for that.
Yeah.
It really is, because you can take the most mundane thing in the universe. I mean, look at Stephen King's The Mangler.
Yes.
Short story, The Mangler.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, you can turn anything into just a satanic killing machine pretty easily. I'm personally waiting for the homicidal wine cork. It's going to happen.
Ooh, and that could get messy, too.
Oh, yeah. One of those nice little CO2 jobs. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, baby. Right through the ear. Yeah.
Nice.
Sorry, what are you talking about?
Being messed up on hallucinogens, I think it was.
Oh, yeah. It's a fun time. You haven't tried it? Do it. holy shit. Are we recording?
Yes.
Then try writing while you're doing it. That's always fun.
Oh, you know, I have to say
the keyboard keeps crawling away from me.
I've had one experience, and I did write a poem, and it actually didn't turn out too badly. And it actually was legible, which was really scary considering my handwriting, and you could actually follow it, which is even more terrifying. But you know, the bottom line is you find as horror writers or science fiction writers, any kind of genre fiction, you know, what you want to do is you want to let your subconscious have a time to play.
Yes.
And I think all writers have to let the subconscious do some damage. It's there, it's penned up, it's seen all this crap, and it wants to talk. So you just let it talk.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just guide it a little bit, but you know, the stories that I've written that I have the most confidence in are the ones that write themselves.
Yeah,
are the
exactly.
ones where I was told by the voices, ooh, the scary voices, to you know, basically this is what happened, this is how it is. And I hear that voice in my head and I know it's something I just need to write. It's not enough to have an idea for a story, but if you don't find a voice for it, you're dead.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's you know, I tell people, you know, if you want a snapshot of what is in my head on an almost daily basis, read my horror stories, because that really is my sort of I'm tapping into my own not even really subconscious, because I'm, you know, I'm conscious of this kind of
right.
stuff, but you know, tapping into that old darker side of my persona. And that whole darker side of what's in all of us, I think, you know, at least I hope, because if it's just me, then
No, it's not just you.
But
all you got to do is look at Jake and I and go, yeah,
yeah, yeah.
I'm not the only twisted man out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's that sort of look into, and it makes people uncomfortable. But you can use that to do all kinds of interesting things. So yeah, I do all my writing sober, but I wouldn't want to imagine what would come out if I've always wanted to try writing down my dreams, because I could imagine that would be interesting, but I've never done the thing of keeping a notebook by my bed to see what that's like.
Right.
My handwriting's bad enough when I've been awake for a few hours. But
no kidding. I know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. But I mean, I think there's times, but you know, sometimes I lay down for a nap after work and I don't really sleep. I just kind of drowse.
Right.
My wife calls it imagination time. As I get older, I enjoy imagination time even more.
Yep.
God, it's sad. I'm only 40. Holy crap. But, you know, it's really strange, though, because I'll be able to sit down or, you know, lay down. What's the difference? I'm 40, for God's sake. You know, and crack open a beer and fall asleep watching the baseball game. And, you know, basically just kind of try and clear my mind out, which isn't hard because I don't have much brains. And just kind of let the images just kind of come, or the ideas, and just kind of, you know, just kind of flow with them. And sometimes it's very helpful as a writer, because sometimes if you're stuck on a problem, you know, the best way to solve a problem is by not looking at it.
Yes.
And that, you know, as being a software developer, that also works in software all the damn time. You'll be thinking about something completely different, and suddenly your brain will go, oh, by the way, yeah. Since you weren't looking over here, we solved this problem for you. Here's the answer. You go, damn it! I've been staring at this for 15 hours. All I had to do was think of Smurfs, and I found the solution. You know, it works like that. But, you find those connections back and forth, and usually, I mean, I used to do this all the time. The wife can vouch for it. I'd wake up at like 2 in the morning, jump out of bed, and immediately go after the computer. Because sometimes my subconscious will have just untied a knot somewhere.
Yeah.
And it immediately just threw me out of bed, and I had to go do something about it. I had to go write it down before I lost it. So, you know, you just kind of have to, you know, get into that mindset. We don't always know consciously what the hell it is we're trying to do.
Exactly.
And, you know, I gave up pretending I know what I'm doing a long time ago, and I've been much happier since. So I think it is important for us as writers, regardless of genre, to dream and to allow ourselves to get stupid and entertain really dumb ideas. really dumb ideas.
Oh, that's you know, when I had this idea that I'm working on now, last night I tweeted this idea is either really stupid or stupidly awesome
or brilliant. Well, it's like closet trees. I didn't want to write closet trees because people were like, "Why don't you write that story? Why don't you write that story?" It's like, it's too cliche. I don't want to write that. It's too cliche. And they're like,
write it.
It's too cliche. Yeah. I finally found a way to make it not cliche, and it turned out it wasn't even about that part of things. And I think you find those ways around the fiction to find the way to tell the story. You find the actual story, which is not necessarily the story you thought you were going to write. I think that's what makes horror so interesting, is because you can see that. There's so much, in older horror especially, there's so much social commentary going on. There is so much examination of the human condition that you could not get in most of the quote-unquote American literature books that are out there, because people can have this other foil to play with. And I think that's what was really important. I'd love to see children's literature written that way. I'd love it. Yeah. If you can pull it off, dude, my hat's off to you. I'm not a kid. I'll buy this stuff just to read it to see what you did. Because, I think it's very important. I think it's also very, very cool that you're trying to do that. I don't have the balls to do it. I'm a scaredy cat. There's no way I'd try and write a children's book. I'd end up getting censored or something. Shit, maybe I should try that. Anyway,
there you go.
Again, it hurt.
Again, stuffing, you know.
Yeah. That's right. It's just I'm tricking Ernie out. So, I do think that that's an important thing to keep track of. And I'd like to think that books like the Forever Formula that I read in when I was in junior high, did you guys remember that book, or was it just being too old?
Maybe, well, I mean, you and I are the same age.
Yeah,
but
you're not too old, dude. I'm almost same age. I turned 38 at the end of the month, so right there along with you.
Snapper boy.
Yeah, that's me.
There was a book called The Forever Formula, and it had some pretty gruesome parts to it, but it was all about people trying to live forever. And the fact that they had come up with this chemical that they could take, and all the old people, once they reached like past 90 or whatever, became translucent.
Yeah.
And it got really ugly really fast, as you can imagine. But the bottom line, that has some real horror elements to it, just from the fact that these people had lived so long and some of their faculties were starting to break down, but they were still in the perfect mind of health. But imagine having an entire generation of folks living to be 130 years old, but had Alzheimer's for the last 40 years of it.
Mm. Right.
Yeah.
Think of what kind of world that would be for a second.
Right.
Those of us who are getting to the point where our parents are reaching that age, we probably have seen our grandparents go through it, and it's not pretty. And I think the guy – I can't remember the author's name for the life of me, but the guy who wrote the Forever Formula really, I think, in a lot of ways saw the writing on the wall. And it was a quote-unquote science fiction book, but it had all these different elements of what I would consider traditional horror in it. It had all that stuff in there. And I think that it was a freaking scholastic book.
Yeah.
You know, it's for 12 and 13-year-olds. But it still made a very profound impact on me. I mean, I can remember it. I'm 40 freaking years old now. I probably read it 27 years ago.
Can't even remember if you put on your underwear this morning or not.
Hey, man, I'm falling. What do you want from me? Underwear? That. Underwear's for losers. Screw that, man. I'm gonna free ball it. When the sweat comes, I got the ball butted in the jeans. You know what I'm talking about? Anyway, done with my Scott Silver impression. I think it's very important to, you know, regardless of what genre you're writing, to actually consider those elements in what you're doing. And I think magical realism, which I would say Horns is actually closer to magical realism than is horror, but it has so many horror elements, I can see why it's cast as a horror book.
Right.
But so much of it is magical realism just because it's quote unquote literary. Horror cannot be literary. It must be magical realism. So I think there's a lot of that stuff that we can actually look at and learn from. But in children's literature, imagine you have to go not the same tax guy. You're going to have to look at what the folks are doing. Obviously, you got to tell it your own way and your own story. But I think those are really great ideas to latch onto.
Yeah.
Well, and I think children's, you know, stories, writing for children, is the last frontier where you can tackle taboos, where you can tackle non, you know, PC things, and it still has weight and matters. That's what I mean. The classic horror, you know, like you said, it's definitely, you know, it tells a story of society. There's the morality plays, there's all of that. The problem is now in society, and I think one reason why we don't have such great horror, I know there's some out there definitely, but we've broken down so many walls in our society that basically all that's left to do is torture porn. You know, I mean, really, it's just to make it as grotesque and awful as possible, because the morality plays don't work as well because society's morals have been, you know, shot out the window.
That's a bunch of shite. Really, no. What it came down. No, no, Jake, that's bullshit. Okay,
I mean, you don't have. Today, you don't have the naivete of believing you can duck and cover. You don't have that great specter of the red menace. You don't have, you know, this, you know, women have to dress with this length of skirt. They have to do this. They have to do that. You don't have the repressed man who must wear a tie every single day, who has to in society, whether you work at a job that needs a tie or not. You don't have any of that anymore. And that was part of what fueled a lot of the great horror that was there. You don't have those walls that you can peek over, that you can punch a hole through to, you know, see what's on the other side. You don't have that anymore. It's a lot more difficult to get that emotion, get that feeling, to draw from that repression. You know, from being feeling put down or whatever. It's harder to do that in adult horror now, because basically walls have been broken down. You're not going to shock. You're not going to have the same impact. In fact, you might look a little, you know, cliche and blah doing something like that. Whereas writing for children, they still have those walls.
Okay. All right. I see what,
you see
you're
what
saying.
I'm saying? But okay.
I would say that the walls have changed for adult fiction. The walls have actually changed for childhood fiction too. I mean, there's a lot of things that we talk about now that are on TV now that, you know, the idea of them being on TV when I was 13, I mean, I just cannot freaking believe it, you know?
Right.
This is not a case of kids get off my lawn. I'm not that sentimental about my childhood. I'm just not. I had a great childhood and I'm not that sentimental about it. I think that the walls have changed. They've moved.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But it's not that they've gotten higher. It's that they've gotten in a different configuration.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say the same thing about adults too. When you talk about torture porn, being like the, I think the media is what's made that the last frontier.
Oh yeah, completely.
And basically Saw is what brought that on, in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
but the success of something like Insidious, which albeit, I mean, it made, like I told you guys, it was made for $750,000 or something like that. It made like $20 million in the theaters.
Wow!
It has made another $15 or $20 million on DVD.
Oh yeah!
Start thinking about that for a second. Think of the numbers.
Oh yeah!
It's ridiculous. It had Barbara Hershey in it, for God's sake. Okay, she must have done that movie for nothing. Because she just believed in it or whatever else. The bottom line is what that movie got at was those core things that make us scream in our worst nightmares. It Yep. doesn't take gore. It doesn't take torture porn. It doesn't take a whole bunch of grotesqueries that are going on. It has to do with messing with the imagination and messing with the brain.
Right.
And guys, you've heard me bitch about this before, about jump scares. The scariest part of that entire movie for me was this slow pan where you just see this shadow sitting in the corner and pointing. And is the most terrifying thing I have seen in forever because of the way it is done. And if you can capture something like that and put it in your books, you're going to make $1 billion. Because people are going to want to read that. Because people love to be touched on that level. And it's just amazing to watch somebody who knows how to do it right.
You know, and I will say, to Jake's point, it has gotten harder. But and that I think the reason that the Saw movies of, you know, the past few years have done well is because they do it in they touch those places in a different way, in a way that's easy.
Right.
You know, it's easy to evoke those sorts of feelings with that level of gore or what have you. It's trickier to elicit those same sorts of emotions with a degree of subtlety. But the thing is, it's going to last longer. It's going to be something people are going to remember more and longer. So, you know, it all depends on what you as a writer want to do. Do you want to go the quick, easy way, or do you want to go the way that takes a little more time and a little more talent? And I want to go the quick, easy way and make $1 billion and retire at 45. No, I mean, I want to go, you know, I want to go the way where people are going to be talking about it and they're going to be thinking about it, you know, 20 or 30 years after they read what I wrote. So yeah, I mean, you know, it may be easier because the walls, it may be harder because the walls have been broken down, and so people are taking the easy way out when it comes to scaring people, or at least eliciting, you know, really base reactions, whether that's fear or just, you know, a gross out.
Right.
Because there are different levels and layers of fear, and
I guess basically to do good, successful horror in this day and age, you have to find the walls.
Yeah.
And you've got to be able to peek over them for the reader. You've got to be able to punch one brick out for the reader so they see just that little bit that they can only see through that one hole there. You know, give them that little peek through that's, you know, like, ah, but there's a wall there. There's supposed to be a wall there. Why am I looking through? And that's going to be the trick for great horror now, is finding those walls. And they're harder and harder to find. And, you know, maybe the journey through the dark woods to find that wall will be just as good. But it is, you know, it's not that they aren't out there. It's, like I said, it's harder and harder to find them. And, you know, I guess that's the writer's journey now, if you're going to be writing, you know, good, meaningful horror. And I know people would argue there's, you know, meaningful horror. What do you mean? But, you know,
whatever.
If you understand horror, you know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, you know, that's, and one thing I think with, you know, I haven't seen, you know, Insidious, but I mean, isn't kind of the whole horror of it, isn't it centered around a child?
It has a lot to do with the child, but it also has a lot to do with children.
Right. But I mean, see, but then also that kind of brings you back into that place.
Well, yeah. I mean, whenever we get to the point where, you know, the Fear Shop guys, and I've also heard this on Bloody Good Horror, they say that the scariest freaking things in horror movies are small children and old people.
And clowns.
And, well, leave clowns out of this, because, good God, then you start the Ice Cream Man thing and I go crazy. Literally go crazy.
I'm just thinking Poltergeist, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You want me never to sleep again? That was me at 13.
Yeah, I hear you, man.
Bastard. whenever you bring a child into it, whenever you bring a child and the things that are happening to a child into it, it does touch some part of us, whether we have children or not. I mean, I'm 40 years old. I'm the only one in this podcast that doesn't have kids, okay?
Yeah.
But the bottom line is that stuff hurts me bad. It really hits me to the center, to the core. Looks like The Shining ripped me up bad because I'm terrified about this 12-year-old. What's going to happen to this 12-year-old?
Exactly. Once you bring kids into it, you bring walls into the story.
Sure, and that's what, you know, I've been told over and over again. The scariest thing about Closet Trees was the fact that it's about a goddamn ice cream man.
Yeah.
There's a strong point in that, and everybody's seen the freaking ice cream man and remembers their kids, and now they're terrified because I basically struck a nerve. This is the guy who's supposed to bring you confectionery delights, not dismemberment. And therefore, you know, taking this standard everyday thing that we would look back with some sentimentality on and turning it into something dark and twisted is very ripping. I mean, it just rips at some core of us.
Yeah.
But, you know, kids, you know, remembering back when we were children, remembering how stupid we were and naive, just the dumbest things we would do and not even realize what the possible outcomes are. And then when you start entering in these other larger pictures into it with much larger consequences than we could even possibly imagine at that age. That's what makes it very, very compelling. I mean, that's what makes it work. You know, Stephen King's It works because of that.
Right.
You know, half the story is told from when they were kids, half the story is told when they were adults. The more compelling part of that story is when they were kids.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the part of the book that works the best.
Yeah, exactly. There'd be no adult story without that childhood backstory. There would be nothing there. It would just be like, okay, you whiners. You know, it had to have that foundation that was there. So yeah, totally.
And I think it's just you know, Insidious is a story about adults that centers around a child,
right.
There are so many stories that we look at, like Poltergeist. Poltergeist is a story of adults that centers around a child. It's exactly the same thing. And I think The Shining, you could argue, is almost right there as well. It's about really an adult who's trying to hold his sanity together and loses it, just completely loses it. And it somehow recaptures it at the end. Let's not go into the happy ending bullshit. Sorry, I hate happy endings. Although that's not really a happy ending because there's some major damage done and those people got to live with.
It's a redeeming ending, but not necessarily happy.
It's not a happy, it's a redemptive ending.
Yes.
I mean, I'm okay with redemptive endings. I believe in redemptive endings. So I think that there is a lot to be said for that. Like you said, when you bring a child into the picture, you're bringing a whole different set of walls. You're absolutely true. You're absolutely correct in that. And I think that is one of the things that we find as writers a fun place to play, regardless of our genre. The moment you bring a child into it, oh my God, there's all this baggage that goes along with it that you can play with.
Yes.
I mean, how many of us remember sitting in our bed looking at the bookcase with our Star Wars figures on it, and they seem to move.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Or they cast weird shadows or whatever else. What about stuffed animals? Shit, my wife has a ton of stuffed animals in the guest bedroom. I can't sleep in there.
Even in the dark, I
walk in there and I see those shapes and I go, shit, that stuff's going to move over and kill me. Because this is how twisted I still am at 40. It just still, those memories of childhood do not go away. They just don't. And Jake had the bad taste to remember to mention clowns. The stuffed clown toy and Poltergeist, that thing haunted my nightmares for like 2 years.
Yep, exactly.
I mean, you know, it's just, oh my God. It's so powerful to grab onto an image like that and pull it through. And that's the stuff that sticks with us. The things that stick with us are playing upon the naivete of our youth.
Yes.
And that's what really just if you can do it right, it will just put the tenor hooks into your flesh and rip your heart out.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. It's awesome in that way, but at the same time, it's extremely sick, twisted, and disturbing. You know, if it's not sick, twisted, and disturbing, it's probably not horror. So, all right.
That's right.
I guess maybe that's the key. The key to great horror is finding what scares that inner child in you. I mean, if you look at Poltergeist, it really is basically a child's buzzkill through the whole thing. It ruins TV. It ruins all toys. It ruins clowns.
Swimming
it
pools.
Ruins a great climbing tree. It ruins the promise of a swimming pool. I mean, it ruins freaking everything for every kid. It's just like it shits on it all.
I never thought about that, but boy, did you just peg it. That's absolutely true. Absolutely yeah. True. And basically, when you run and walk away from Poltergeist, we're old and jaded now, but back when we were kids, holy crap, the reason it scared you, the shit out of me anyway, was the fact that nothing was safe. I mean, nothing. Absolutely nothing. The damn teddy bear that looks so cute in the daylight could be just walking up and torturing and just strangling you to death 5 minutes later.
See, that television for me, the clown thing didn't resonate with me because I didn't have clown, you know.
I didn't have clowns either. It doesn't matter. The son of a bitch was terrifying even when it was just sitting there before it started moving around. Exactly.
For me, it was the television, you know, the snow. To this day, if televisions could still do that, I don't think they can anymore.
they can't. They go black screen now.
If you could still get the snow, I would not be able to watch the snow for more than a second or two before just having to turn the television off because my brain would start to see things.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, and I think that's one of the things that Spielberg, being the asshole that he is, was playing with is the fact that your brain is going to make patterns out of nothing. If you've got a static, pardon the pun, if you've got some kind of static background, your brain's going to get bored with it. And it's going to start finding patterns in the tiniest little incongruities. And that's how you see things. That's how you see things. And whenever I think about psychosis and delusions, that's kind of the way I look at it, is that there is a pattern there. It may be very subtle, but it's discernible to some part of the brain that's busted. And when it sees that pattern, it makes up this whole mythos around it. And that's how you get a delusion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the way I think about some of my more quote-unquote colorful characters. is that is indeed the way their brains work. And I agree with you. Static thing, that scares the shit out of me this day. I have a monitor at work. I shit you not. It gets confused at times. When I plug in my laptop the first time, it gets confused. It can't figure out if it's supposed to be on HDMI, on VGA, or on DVI. So its default is go to the HDMI. And when it goes to HDMI, it goes to static.
Nice.
And and I agree with you, Scott. It still creeps the shit out of me. I'm reaching, stabbing for that source button in the freaking dark, trying to make the damn thing. It's not lit to change that screen even to black as quickly as possible. Because to this day, I'm 40 years old. I saw that movie when I was like 13. The idea of static on a screen scares the hell out of me. Because I'm waiting for the little ghostly hands to come out and just start screwing up everything. So, I mean, it's just one of those images that has stuck around. And, man, you know, that means that Spielberg just hit it. He just hit it.
Yes.
I don't care whether it affects anybody today. The bottom line is there are at least three of us on this podcast, and that's 100%, who still remember that movie, and parts of it still resonate with us as adults.
Oh,
and
he
hit it correctly.
Yep.
Well, that's a good note, I think, to end this particular grindstone on. We crossed the hour mark about 20 minutes ago.
Excellent.
Well, considering we spent about 25 minutes trying to find a topic, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, I'm not going to cry about that. So I want to thank you guys for coming on.
All righty.
Always.
Let our audience know once again where we can find you and what you're working on at the moment. So, ladies first, Jake.
That's funny. You can find me at jakebible.com. That's an easy one to remember. And currently, right now, I am just trying to get my frickin' side quilt to Dead Mech out, The Americans, working on the edits, and it should be available in ebook. It will be available ebook before the holiday season, and hopefully print same time, but I'm not holding my breath on that.
Don't hold your breath.
Nice.
But ebook definitely will be available by the time all those great Christmas Kindles show up. So.
Fantastic.
Right, my Paul? Name is Paul Ellard Cooley. You can find my work at shadowpublications.com. You can also find my work at amazon.com, bnn.com. I've got Fiendlets, was a collection of four stories from the Fiends collection, which also has author notes, version of Tattoo with author notes, and pretty soon version of Closet Treats will be up there. You can also check out my new podcast novel called Garaga's Children.
Loving Garaga's Children, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Which is basically takes place in ancient history and is slowly moving forward time period to time period. Volume 1 is available on patiobooks.com as well as in shadowpublications.com feed, which you can find on iTunes. And there will be more coming hopefully soon.
Fantastic. Well, I can be found at scottroche.com. I have a young adult science fiction novel out called Jenny Dare, which you can find links to right there on the main page at scottroche.com. Also, I have a lot of horror fiction, including a horror anthology, Through Glass Darkly, can't even remember the name of my own freaking book. and hopefully the Podiobooks version of that will be coming out in time for the holiday season, and I will have the Podiobooks version of Jenny Dare out at some point in this decade. with that, we want to thank you for listening, and we will see you next time we decide to get together and talk about horror.
Let's get together next week.
Nice.
Oh, all right. Boom.
Welcome to the interwebs, home of everything. Would you like to try the new Fruity Odie Slusho?
What do you want?
A podcast?
What kind of podcast?
Give me one with affable hosts talking about geeky things they do.
I want one with geek-related news.
Anything else?
Let me see. How about a podcast with sometimes interesting topics or celebrity interviews?
Yeah, let me have the one with the fitness tips, the one that talks about patio books, maybe the one that talks about upcoming cons.
If you want all of that, why not get a combo?
You have something that has all of that?
I wouldn't offer it if we didn't.
Is that possible?
Is that legal?
You want this weekly from geekradiodaily.com.
What's that?
A running gag.
So what is this weekly?
It's the sometimes weekly podcast with stealth geeks who talk about their week, geek news, and it features looks at patio books, fit club, and con updates.
I don't know.
One of the hosts is a woman.
Oh, really?
With a sexy voice.
So, Geek Radio Daily has forums for geek talks, an active Facebook and Twitter page, and the award non-winning sometimes weekly podcast. All this and more at geekradiodaily.com.